which had been unblemished, was now clouded by the incident of letting Valerie James use the bathroom in the off-site facility. Thomas Picard, the deputy director of the bureau, reputedly told O'Neill that his career was going nowhere. The job went to Mon. Mon was still feeling bruised by the campaign O'Neill had waged against him when the two men happened to meet at a seminar at the FBI Academy in Quantico just after the decision was announced. Mon answered a knock at his door and found O'Neill holding two beers.
"I understand you're an Irishman," O'Neill explained.
Wary about the prospect of working together, Mon told O'Neill that he was going to need people in the office who were loyal to him. "I'm not sure I can depend on you," he stated flatly, offering to find O'Neill another job, possibly in the New Jersey bureau. O'Neill pleaded to stay in New York for family reasons. He said that if Mon would keep him on,
"I'll be more loyal to you than your closest friend."
"You'll still have to prove yourself to me," Mon warned. O'Neill agreed.
"The only thing I ask in return is that you be supportive of me," he said.
Mon made the bargain, but he soon learned that supporting O'Neill would be a full-time job. There is an anecdote that counterterrorism officials often tell about the rendition of Ramzi Yousef. After being captured in Pakistan, he was flown into Stewart Airport in Newburgh, New York, and then transferred to an FBI helicopter for the trip to the Metropolitan Correctional Center next to Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan. "Two huge guys carried him off the plane, shackled him, blindfolded," remembered Shaliro. "After we got airborne and were flying down the Hudson River, one of the SWAT guys asked me, 'Can we take off his blindfold?' It took Yousef a minute to focus his eyes. Ironically, the helicopter was alongside the World Trade Center. The SWAT guy gives him a nudge and says, 'You see, it's still standing.' And Yousef says, 'It wouldn't be if we had had more money.'" Because it was still standing, however, the Trade Center had become a symbol of the success of New York's Joint Terrorism Task Force, a coalition of the FBI, the CIA, the New York City Police Department, the Port Authority, and various other regional and federal agencies. In September 2000, the JTTF chose to celebrate its 20th anniversary there, in the famous Windows on the World banquet room. Some of the representatives looked a little out of place in black tie, but this was a night to congratulate themselves. Mayor Rudy Giuliani, a former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, was present, as was Mary Jo White, his successor in that job. She praised the task force for "your close-to-perfect record of successful investigations and convictions," which included Yousef and six other World Trade Center bombers, as well as Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman and nine of his followers who had planned to assassinate public officials and blow up New York City landmarks. The people in the room had seen the world of terrorism move from the relatively innocent days of Croatian nationalists and anti-Castro Cubans, who had been more interested in publicity than terror, to the sobering new world of deliberate mass murder. It was a misty night, and the clouds obscured the view from the 106th floor of the tower. O'Neill seemed at ease as he wandered through the room, although some might have wondered why Mary Jo White had omitted his name from the list of FBI officials she chose to acknowledge. Mark Rossini, the new I-49 representative at Alex Station, was there. He had just gotten engaged, and he introduced his fiancée to his boss, a man he idolized. Rossini was one of the sons of John. He studied everything about O'Neill, including his taste in cigars and restaurants. He even dressed like O'Neill. But Rossini had no idea that his mentor's career had been thrown further into turmoil because of a troubling incident that had occurred 2 months earlier. O'Neill had attended a mandated pre-retirement conference in Orlando that July. He had no intention of retiring, and was impatient that he had been forced to attend. But since he was in Florida, he asked Valerie James to join him so they could spend the weekend in Miami. During the conference, O'Neill got a page, and he left the room to return the call. When he returned a few minutes later, the other agents had broken for lunch. His briefcase was missing. O'Neill first called the local police, then Maughan. He admitted that the briefcase contained some classified emails and one highly sensitive document, the annual field office report, which contained an itemized breakdown of every national security operation in New York. Both the director of the FBI and the attorney general would have to be notified.
"It's hideous,"
O'Neill told Valerie when he came back to the room. He was ashen. Police found the briefcase a couple of hours later in another hotel. A Mont Blanc pen had been stolen, along with a silver cigar cutter and an expensive lighter. The papers were intact, and fingerprint analysis soon established that they had not been touched. But it was another careless mistake at a pregnable moment in his career. Even though O'Neill immediately reported the theft, and none of the information had been compromised, the Justice Department ordered a criminal inquiry. Maughan thought that was absurd. He would have recommended an oral reprimand, or, at worst, a letter of censure. People took work home all the time, he observed. They just never had it stolen. He felt guilty because he had been pushing O'Neill to get the A4 completed, and O'Neill was just doing what he had asked. Despite their competition for the top job in New York, Maughan had become O'Neill's staunchest defender. Maughan appreciated that excellence was the enemy of any bureaucracy, and that a forceful personality was essential to fight off the interagency rivalries and departmental jealousies that sap the will of the best people. They were the ones who needed to be protected and encouraged. Only then, behind a powerful and visionary leader, could a heartless bureaucracy like the FBI achieve anything remarkable. O'Neill was such a leader. He had made the New York office the most effective branch in the Bureau, but it had come at great cost, as Maughan slowly realized. The enemies that O'Neill had accumulated in his polarizing bureaucratic struggle were eager to destroy him, and now he had given them an opening. Al-Qaeda had developed a management philosophy that it called centralization of decision and decentralization of execution. Bin Laden decided on the targets, selected the leaders, and provided at least some of the funding. After that, the planning of the operation and the method of attack were left to the men who would have the responsibility of carrying it out. That approach had worked well in the embassy bombings, but the operation's schedule for the millennium had gone awry. One had been a comical fiasco, the attempted bombing of USS the Sullivans at the end of Ramadan, when the fiberglass skiff that was supposed to attack the destroyer had foundered so ignominiously in Aden's harbor. Originally, the intention had been to attack an oil tanker off the coast of Yemen. Bin Laden, characteristically, urged the planners to be more ambitious. He wanted them to sink an American warship. When that failed, Bin Laden demanded that the two suicide bombers be replaced. The local supervisor of that operation, Abdulrahim al-Nashiri, stoutly disagreed with Bin Laden. He argued that one of the bombers had been injured in the cruise missile attack on the Al-Qaeda training camps, and it would be unjust to take away the opportunity to strike an American ship that might well have been a participant in that attack. Moreover, the team had trained together for a year and a half, and Nashiri had built a sophisticated new bomb, one with shaped charges that would concentrate the force of the explosion in one direction. Everything was ready for the next U.S. Navy warship to call at the Yemeni port. Bin Laden relented and let his supervisor retain control of the operation. He also released a video in which he threatened America with another assault. As in the interview with ABC before the embassy bombings, he included a teasing clue. This time he wore a distinctive, curved Yemeni dagger in his belt. Next to him, Zawahiri declared, "Enough of words. It is time to take action." Aden perches on the slope of a former volcano, the collapsed cone of which forms one of the finest deep-water ports in the world. The name derives from the belief that this is the site of the Garden of Eden. It is also said to be the spot where Noah launched his ark, and where Cain and Abel are buried. Steeped in legend and antiquity, the city had known prosperity during the British era, which ended in 1967, when the country split apart and the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen began its rocky experiment with secular socialism. The lines of fracture were still evident in 1994, after the war had ended and the country was reunited. Decades of violence and instability had left Aden much reduced from the cosmopolitan port it once had been. Docked at a fueling buoy was the USS Cole, a billion-dollar guided missile destroyer. Using advanced stealth technology, the sleek warship was designed to be less visible to radar. But it was starkly evident in the Aden Harbor, more than 500 feet long, displacing 8,300 tons, with its swirling antenna scanning the skies for any foreseeable threat. The Cole was one of the U.S. Navy's most survivable ships, with 70 tons of armor shielding its vital spaces. Passive protection for chemical, biological, or nuclear attack, and a hull capable of withstanding an explosion of 51,000 pounds per square inch. In addition to Tomahawk cruise missiles, which it had launched in Operation Infinite Reach, the Cole carried anti-ship and anti-aircraft missiles, a 5-inch cannon, and the Phalanx close-in weapons system, which fires 50 20-millimeter shells per second. The ship's network of computers and radars, called Aegis, was capable of simultaneously tracking hundreds of incoming missiles or aircraft more than 200 miles away. The Cole was superbly designed to fight the Soviet Navy. On October 12, 2000, at 11:15 a.m., as the Cole was preparing to get underway, a fiberglass fishing boat approached its massive prey. Some of the sailors were standing watch, but many were below decks or waiting in the chow line. Two men brought the tiny skiff to a halt amidships, smiled and waved, then stood at attention. The symbolism and the asymmetry of this moment were exactly what bin Laden had dreamed of. "The destroyer represented the capital of the West," he said, "and the small boat represented Muhammad." The shockwave of the enormous explosion in the harbor knocked over cars on shore. 2 miles away, people thought there was an earthquake. In a taxi in the city, the concussion shook Fahd Akuso, a member of the Al-Qaeda support team who was running late. He was supposed to have videotaped the attack, but he slept through the page on his phone that would have notified him to set up the camera. A fireball rose from the waterline and swallowed a sailor who had leaned over the rail to see what the men in the little boat were up to. The blast opened a hole 40 feet by 40 feet in the port side of the ship, tearing apart sailors who were waiting for lunch. 17 of them perished, and 39 were wounded. Several of the sailors swam through the blast hole to escape the flames. The great modern man of war was gaping open like a gutted animal. Within hours of the attack on the Cole, Barry Mon called headquarters and demanded that the New York office gain control of the investigation. "It's Al-Qaeda," he told Tom Bacard. He wanted O'Neill to be the on-scene commander. As he had during the embassy bombings investigation, Bacard declined, saying there was no proof that Al-Qaeda was involved. He intended to send the Washington field office instead. Mon went over his head, appealing the decision to Louis Free, who immediately agreed that it was New York's case. But the question of sending O'Neill was controversial. "John's my guy," Mon insisted. There was no one else with O'Neill's experience and commitment. He was told, "If it falls on bad times, it's your ass." "I can live with that," said Mon. O'Neill was overjoyed. It would be his best chance to break up the criminal enterprise of Al-Qaeda, and perhaps his last opportunity to redeem his career. "This is it for me," he told a friend in Washington. O'Neill had learned many lessons since his first day on the job in Washington 5 years before, when he coordinated the Ramzi-Yusuf rendition.
One of those lessons was to stockpile supplies on skids at Andrews Air Force Base so that a rapid response team would be ready to go at any moment. In little more than 24 hours after the explosion, O'Neill and about 60 FBI agents and support staff were in the air. They had to stop first in Germany to await clearance from the Yemen authorities, who were still claiming that the explosion had been an accident. Coincidentally, many of the injured sailors were also in Germany, having been flown to the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center, the largest American hospital outside the United States. O'Neill took his investigators directly to the ward where the sailors were being treated. While the bomb technician swept the victim's hair and clothing for residue, O'Neill went through the room with a naval investigator, talking to the wounded sailors. They were young men and women, most of them not yet out of their teens, some of them missing limbs, some horribly burned. Three of the sailors were too badly wounded to be interviewed. One of them, Petty Officer Kathy Lopez, was completely swathed in bandages, but she insistently motioned that she wanted to say something. A nurse put her ear to the sailor's lips to hear the whispered words. She said, "Get them." As soon as Ali Soufan, the young Arabic-speaking agent recently assigned to the I-49 squad, got on the plane to Yemen, O'Neill told him that he was the case agent for the USS Cole, the biggest assignment of his career. Soufan is a highly caffeinated talker, his voice carrying a hint of Lebanon, the country where he was born. He knew what it was like to live in lawlessness and chaos, to see cities destroyed. His family fled to America during the Civil War, and he loved America because it allowed him to dream. In return, America embraced him. His experience was completely opposite to that of the alienated Muslims in the West who had turned to Islamism as a way of finding an identity. He never personally experienced prejudice because he was an Arab or a Muslim. On the contrary, he was elected president of his student body and presented with many academic awards. After gaining his master's degree in international relations at Villanova University, he planned to get his PhD at Cambridge, but he had developed a fascination with the American Constitution. And like many naturalized citizens, he had a feeling of indebtedness for the new life he had been given. As he stood poised on the brink of an academic career, he decided, as a joke, to send his resume to the FBI. He thought the chances that a Muslim American scholar of Arab extraction would be hired by the Bureau were laughably remote. But he was drawn by the mystique, and obviously something inside him cried out to be saved from the classroom. As he was packing to go to England, the response came. Report to the FBI Academy in 2 weeks. O'Neill had drafted him on the squad because of his language ability, but he soon came to value Soufan's initiative, imagination, and courage. When the plane landed in Aden, the agents looked out upon a detachment of the Yemen Special Forces, wearing yellow uniforms with old Russian helmets, each soldier pointing an AK-47 at the plane. The jittery hostage rescue team, who had been sent along to protect the investigators, immediately responded by breaking out their M4s and their handguns. Soufan realized they were all going to die in a bloodbath on the tarmac if he didn't do something quickly. He opened the plane's door. One man among the yellow uniforms was holding a walkie-talkie. Soufan walked directly toward him, carrying a bottle of water, while the guns followed him. It was about 110 degrees outside. Behind their weapons, the Yemeni soldiers were wilting. "You look thirsty," Soufan said in Arabic to the officer with the walkie-talkie. He handed him the bottle of water. "Is it American water?" the officer asked. Soufan assured him that it was. Moreover, he told the man he had American water for all the others as well. They treated it as such a precious commodity that some would not drink it. With this simple act of friendship, the soldiers lowered their weapons, and Soufan gained control of the airport. O'Neill was a little puzzled to find the soldiers saluting as he disembarked. I told him you were a general, Sufan confided. One of the first things O'Neill noticed was a sign for Bin Laden Group International, a subsidiary of the Saudi Bin Laden Group, which had a contract to rebuild the airport after it was damaged in the 1994 civil war. It was a small reminder that he was playing on his opponent's court. O'Neill had already spent some time studying the country. He was reading a book by Tim McIntosh Smith titled Yemen, The Unknown Arabia. He learned that Sana'a, the capital, claimed to be the world's first city, and that the Hadramut, Bin Laden's homeland, meant death has come. He underlined these facts with his Mont Blanc ballpoint in a firm, straight hand, as he always did when he was reading. He was determined not to be defeated by the exoticism. His real adversary, however, turned out to be his own ambassador, Barbara Bodine. She had personally negotiated the agreements between the United States and Yemen 2 years before, which allowed American warships to refuel in Aden's harbor. That now seemed a calamitous miscalculation. They met at 6 o'clock on the morning after O'Neill arrived. In his New Jersey accent, he remarked that he was looking forward to working with her in Yemen. Yemen, she coldly corrected him. From O'Neill's perspective, Yemen was filled with jihadis, and it was still quaking from the civil war. Yemen is a country of 18 million citizens and 50 million machine guns, he later reported. Gunfire was a frequent distraction. The temperature often exceeded 120 degrees, and scorpions were as common as houseflies. Moreover, Yemen was full of spies who were well-equipped with listening devices. One of the largest cells of Zawahiri's al-Jihad operated here, and there were many veterans who had fought with bin Laden in Afghanistan. When the rest of O'Neill's team arrived, he warned them, "This may be the most hostile environment the FBI has ever operated in." Bodine, however, saw Yemen as a promising American ally in an unsettled but strategically crucial part of the world. The country was an infant democracy, far more tolerant than its neighbors. It even allowed women to vote. Unlike O'Neill, the ambassador had plenty of experience working in dangerous places. During the Iraqi invasion and occupation of Kuwait, she had served as deputy chief of mission and stayed through the 137-day siege of the American embassy by Iraqi troops until all the Americans were evacuated. Moreover, Barbara Bodine was as forceful and blunt as John O'Neill. Bodine thought she had an understanding with O'Neill that he would bring in a team of no more than 50. She was furious when many more investigators and support staff arrived. In her mind, it was the same as if a military plane with 300 heavily armed people arrived to take over Des Moines. O'Neill's account, confirmed by other agents and news reports, said that there were only 150 personnel in his group, not 300. She pleaded with O'Neill to consider the delicate diplomatic environment he was entering. O'Neill responded that he was here to investigate a crime, not to conduct diplomacy. That was the kind of answer Bodine had come to expect in her dealings with the FBI. There was the FBI way, and that was it, she had concluded. O'Neill wasn't unique. He was simply extreme. Her goal was to preserve the delicate relations between the United States and Yemen, which she had worked hard to improve. Although one can understand that the State Department and the FBI might have two different agendas, in this case, Bodine had been given clear directives by the Secretary of State to ensure the safety of American investigators and to assist them in their investigation. Those were to be her top priorities, not protecting the relationship with the Yemen government. Instead, she continually worked to lower the Bureau's footprint by reducing the number of agents and stripping them of their heavy weapons, which she said was for their own safety. Meanwhile, on local television each night, the Yemeni parliament featured speakers who were openly calling for jihad against America. Bodine ordered that the entire FBI team be moved to the Aden Hotel, which was crammed with other U.S. military and government employees. O'Neill's investigators were billeted 3 and 4 to a room. 45 FBI personnel slept on mats on the hotel's ballroom floor, O'Neill reported. He set up a command center on the 8th floor of the hotel. 50 Marines guarded the sandbagged hallway. Outside, the hotel was ringed with machine gun nests manned by Yemeni troops. It wasn't entirely clear what their purpose was, other than to make sure the Americans were confined to the hotel. "We were prisoners," one of the agents recalled. Early on the morning after his arrival, O'Neill boarded a launch to the Cole, which was listing in the harbor 1,000 yards offshore. The recovery of the dead was still underway, and bodies lined the deck draped with American flags. Down below, there were clumps of flesh mashed into the tangled mass of wire and metal of a ship that had once seemed so invulnerable. Through the blast hole, O'Neill could see divers searching for bodies, and in the background, the rocky city, embracing the port like an ancient theater. The sailor in charge of refueling the ship told investigators that it normally took about 6 hours for the ship to take on the 240,000 gallons of fuel it required. They were just 45 minutes into the process when the bomb exploded. He had thought the gas line had blown, and he immediately shut off the connection. Then a cloud of black liquid suddenly covered the ship. It was not oily. It was the residue of the bomb. O'Neill spent much of his time coaxing the Yemeni authorities in the Political Security Organization, the equivalent of the FBI, to cooperate with the investigation. He was conscious of the need to build cases that would survive American standards of justice, so his agents would have to be present during interrogations by local authorities to assure U.S. courts that none of the suspects had been tortured. He also sought to gather eyewitness testimony from residents who had seen the explosion. Both the PSO and Bodine resisted these requests. "You want a bunch of 6'2" Irish Americans to go door to door?" Bodine asked O'Neill. "And excuse me, but how many of your guys speak Arabic?" Actually, there were only half a dozen Arabic speakers in the FBI contingent, and language was a constant source of misunderstanding. O'Neill kept Ali Sufan at his side most of the time. Once, when he was talking to an obstructionist colonel in Yemen intelligence, O'Neill exclaimed in frustration, "Christ, this is like pulling teeth!" When the colonel's personal translator repeated the remark in Arabic, the officer stood up visibly angry. "What'd I say?" O'Neill asked Sufan. Sufan told him that the translator had told the colonel, "If you don't answer my questions, I'm going to pull out your teeth." The Yemeni authorities understandably felt encroached upon and unfairly treated. In exchange for the evidence O'Neill was demanding, they wanted access to any information the FBI gathered outside the country, which for legal reasons O'Neill could not provide. The Yemenis finally produced a videotape taken by a harborside security camera, but it appeared to have been edited to delete the crucial moment of the explosion. When O'Neill expressed his frustration to Washington, President Clinton sent a note to President Ali Abdullah Saleh. It had little effect. The FBI was convinced that the bombers had been tipped off about the arrival of the coal, and they wanted to expand the investigation to include a member of the president's own family and a colonel in the PSO. There was scant interest on the part of the Yemen authorities in pursuing such leads. O'Neill had spent his entire career romancing police from other countries. He had found that coppers, as he called them, formed a universal fraternity. And yet some of his requests for evidence mystified the local detectives, who were not acquainted with the advanced forensic techniques the Bureau is famous for. Elementary procedures such as fingerprinting were rarely employed. They couldn't understand, for instance, why O'Neill was requesting a hat worn by one of the conspirators, which he wanted to examine for DNA evidence. Even the harbor sludge, which contained residue from the bomb and bits of the fiberglass fishing boat, was off limits until the Bureau paid the Yemeni government $1 million to dredge it. The debris was loaded onto barges and shipped to Dubai for examination. Yemen was an intensely status-conscious society. And because Sufan had promoted O'Neill to general,
One of his counterparts was General Hamoud Naji, head of presidential security. General Naji finally agreed to take them to the site where the bombers had launched their boat. The police had discovered a 12-year-old boy named Hani, who had been fishing on the pier when the bombers unloaded their skiff. One of the men had paid him 100 Yemeni rials, about 60 cents, to watch his Nissan truck and boat trailer, but he never returned. The police had arrested Hani to make sure he didn't disappear, and then locked up his father as well to take care of him.
"If this is how they treat their cooperating witnesses," O'Neill observed, "imagine how they treat the more difficult ones."
O'Neill also viewed the safe house where the bombers had been living. It was clean and neat. In the master bedroom was a prayer rug oriented to the north toward Mecca. The bathroom sink was full of body hair that the bombers had shaved before going to their deaths. The investigators were solemn, imagining the scene of the ritual ablutions and the final prayers. But cooperation was still very slow in coming.
"This investigation has hit a rock," General Naji admitted. "We Arabs are very stubborn."
Ali Soufan teased him, saying, "You're dealing with another Arab, and I'm also stubborn." When Soufan translated this exchange, O'Neill contended that the Arabs were not the equal of the Irish in that department. He told a story about the O'Neill clan in Ireland, who, he said, had the reputation of being the strongest men in their country. Every year there was a boat race to a giant stone in the middle of a lake, and the O'Neills always won. But one year, another clan was rowing faster and pulling ahead, and it appeared that they would touch the stone first.
"But then my great-grandfather took his sword," said O'Neill, "and he cut off his hand and threw it at the rock. You got anything that can match that?"
Soufan and the general looked at each other. "We're stubborn," said Soufan, "but we're not crazy." One of the problems investigators faced was that the coal was in real danger of sinking. Naval engineers were urgently trying to prevent this indignity. Finally, an immense Norwegian semi-submersible salvage ship with a middle deck designed to dip underwater and scoop up oil platforms arrived to pick up the wounded warship and take it on its long journey home. The public address system of the coal broadcast the Star-Spangled Banner as it piggybacked out of the harbor, followed defiantly by Kid Rock's American Badass. There were so many perceived threats that the agents often slept in their clothes and with their weapons at their sides. The investigators learned from a mechanic that a truck similar to one purchased by the bombers had been brought to his shop to have metal plates installed in a way that might be used to direct the force of an explosion. Certainly the most tempting target for such a bomb would be the hotel where the agents were staying. Bodine thought these fears were overblown. The agents were suspicious of everyone, she observed, including the hotel staff. She assured O'Neill that the gunfire he frequently heard outside the hotel was probably not directed at the investigators, but was simply the noise of wedding celebrations. Then one night, when O'Neill was running a meeting, shots were fired just outside the hotel. The hostage rescue team took positions. Once again, Soufan ventured out to talk to the Yemeni troops stationed in the street.
"Hey, Ali," O'Neill said, "be careful."
He had raced down the steps of the hotel to make sure Soufan was wearing his flak jacket. Frustration, stress, and danger, along with the enforced intimacy of their situation, had brought the two men closer. O'Neill had begun to describe Soufan as his secret weapon. To the Yemenis, he simply called him, "my son." Snipers covered him as Soufan strolled outside. The Yemeni officer stationed there assured him that everything was okay. "If everything is okay, why are there no cars on the street?" Soufan asked. The officer said there must be a wedding nearby. Soufan looked around and saw that the hotel was surrounded with men in traditional dress, some in jeeps, all carrying guns. They were civilians, not soldiers. Soufan was reminded of the tribal uprising in Somalia, which ended with dead American soldiers being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. "That could happen right here, right now," he thought. O'Neill ordered the U.S. Marines to deploy two armored vehicles to block the street in front of the hotel. The night passed without further incident, But the next day, O'Neill relocated his team to the USS Duluth, stationed in the Bay of Aden. He had to get permission from the Yemeni government to fly back to shore. The helicopter pilot had to take evasive maneuvers after the craft was painted by an SA-7 missile. O'Neill sent most of the investigators home. He and Soufan and four other agents moved back to the hotel, now practically empty because of bomb threats. Relations between Bodine and O'Neill deteriorated to the point that Barry Maughan flew to Yemen to assess the situation. It became clear that she simply hated his guts, Maughan observed. But what Bodine told him was that O'Neill couldn't get along with the Yemenis. For the next 10 days, Maughan spoke to members of the FBI team and American military officers. Every night, when the Yemen authorities did business, he would go with O'Neill and watch him interact with his counterparts. The meetings invariably went late, with O'Neill cajoling, pressuring, charming, and treating, doing whatever he could do to inch the process along. One such night, O'Neill complained to General Ghalib Kamish of the PSO that he needed photographs of the suspects that the Yemenis had arrested. The discussion dragged on deep into the early morning hours, with General Kamish politely explaining that the FBI was not needed on this case at all, and O'Neill patiently describing the urgency of the situation. Maughan could barely keep his head up. But the following night, the general announced, "I have your photos for you." O'Neill thanked him, then went on to beg for the right to interview the suspects face-to-face, rather than feeding questions to the Yemeni interrogators. It was an endless and tortuous negotiation, but in Maughan's view, it was carried out with respect and even affection on both sides. General Kamish referred to O'Neill as Brother John. When Maughan returned, he reported to the director that O'Neill was doing a masterful job, adding that Bodine was his only detractor. He said as much to Bodine on his way out of the country. He was not recalling O'Neill, he told her. Of course, Maughan was responsible for sending O'Neill in the first place. He may not have wanted to see Bodine's point of view. In any case, ambassadors have the final say over which Americans are allowed to remain in a foreign country, and O'Neill was not one of them. The Yemenis arrested Fahd al-Kusso, the al-Qaeda cameraman who had overslept his assignment to videotape the bombing, at the end of October. Kusso admitted that he and one of the suicide bombers had delivered $5,000 to Khalad, the one-legged mastermind of the coal attack, in Bangkok. He said the money was to buy Khalad a new prosthesis. The transcript of the conversation was passed along to the FBI a month later. Soufan remembered the name Khalad from a source he had recruited in Afghanistan. The source had described a fighter with a metal leg who was the emir of a guest house in Kandahar, bin Laden's errand boy, he had called him. Soufan and O'Neill faxed Khalad's passport photo to the Afghan source, who made a positive identification. That was the first real link between the coal bombing and al-Qaeda. Soufan wondered why money was leaving Yemen when a major operation was about to take place. Could there be another operation underway that he didn't know about? Soufan sent Khalad's photo to the CIA, asking for information about him and whether there might have been an al-Qaeda meeting in the region. The agency did not respond to his clearly stated request. The fact that the CIA withheld information about the mastermind of the coal bombing and the meeting in Malaysia when directly asked by the FBI hampered the pursuit of justice in the death of 17 American sailors. Much more tragic consequences were on the horizon. A month after the coal investigation began, Assistant FBI Director Dale Watson told the Washington Post, "Sustained cooperation with the Yemenis has enabled the FBI to further reduce its in-country presence. The FBI will soon be able to bring home the FBI's senior on-scene commander, John O'Neill." It appeared to be a very public surrender to Bodine's complaints. The same day, the Yemeni Prime Minister told the Post that no link had been discovered between the coal bombers and al-Qaeda. O'Neill came home just before Thanksgiving. Valerie James was shocked when she saw him,
He had lost 25 pounds. He said that he felt he was fighting the counterterrorism battle alone, without any support from his own government, and he worried that the investigation would grind to a halt without him. Indeed, according to Barry Mann, Yemeni cooperation slowed significantly when O'Neill left the country. Concerned about the continuing threats against the remaining FBI investigators, O'Neill tried to return in January 2001, but Bodin denied his application. Meanwhile, the American investigators, feeling increasingly vulnerable, retreated behind the walls of the American embassy in Sana'a. Soufan finally was allowed to interview Fahd Akuso, the sleeping cameraman, who was small and arrogant, with a wispy beard that he kept tugging on. Before the interview began, a colonel in the PSO entered the room and kissed Kuso on both cheeks, a signal to everyone that Kuso was protected. And indeed, whenever it seemed obvious that Kuso was on the verge of making an important disclosure, the Yemeni colonel would insist that the session stop for meals or prayers. Over a period of days, however, Soufan was able to get Kuso to admit that he met with Khalad and one of the coal bombers in Bangkok, where they stayed at the Washington Hotel. Kuso confessed that his mission was to hand over $36,000 in Al-Qaeda funds, not the $5,000 he had mentioned before, nor was the money for Khalad's new leg. It now seems evident that the money was used to purchase first-class air tickets for the 9/11 hijackers, Mihdar and Hazmi, and support them when they arrived in Los Angeles a few days later, which would have been obvious if the CIA had told the Bureau about the two Al-Qaeda operatives. The FBI agents went through phone records to verify Kuso's story. They found calls between the Washington Hotel in Bangkok and Kuso's house in Yemen. They also noticed that there were calls to both places from a payphone in Malaysia. It happened to be directly outside the condo where the meeting had taken place. Kuso had told Soufan that he was originally supposed to have met Khalad in Kuala Lumpur or Singapore. He couldn't seem to get the two cities straight. Once again, Soufan sent an official teletype to the agency. He sent along a passport picture of Khalad. Do these telephone numbers make any sense? Is there any connection to Malaysia? Any tie to Khalad? Again, the agency had nothing to say. If the CIA had responded to Soufan by supplying him with the intelligence he requested, the FBI would have learned of the Malaysia meeting and of the connection to Mihdar and Hazmi. The Bureau would have learned, as the agency already knew, that the Al-Qaeda operatives were in America and had been for more than a year. Because there was a pre-existing indictment for bin Laden in New York and Mihdar and Hazmi were his associates, the Bureau already had the authority to follow the suspects, wiretap their apartment, intercept their communications, clone their computer, investigate their contacts, all the essential steps that might have prevented 9/11. In June 2001, Yemeni authorities arrested eight men who they said were part of a plot to blow up the American embassy in Yemen, where Soufan and the remainder of the FBI investigators had taken refuge. New threats against the FBI followed, and Free, acting on O'Neill's recommendation, withdrew the team entirely. The strike on the coal had been a great victory for bin Laden. Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan filled with new recruits, and contributors from the Gulf states arrived carrying Samsonite suitcases filled with petrodollars, as in the glory days of the Afghan jihad. At last there was money to spread around. The Taliban leadership, which was still divided about bin Laden's presence in the country, became more compliant when cash appeared, despite the threat of sanctions and reprisals. Bin Laden separated his senior leaders, Abu Hafs to another location in Kandahar, and Zawahiri to Kabul, so that the anticipated American response would not kill the Al-Qaeda leadership all at once. But there was no American response. The country was in the middle of a presidential election, and Clinton was trying to burnish his legacy by securing a peace agreement between Israel and Palestine. The coal bombing had occurred just as the talks were falling apart. Clinton maintains that, despite the awkward political timing, His administration came close to launching another missile attack against bin Laden that October. But at the last minute, the CIA recommended calling it off because his presence at the site was not completely certain. Bin Laden was angry and disappointed. He hoped to lure America into the same trap the Soviets had fallen into, Afghanistan. His strategy was to continually attack until the U.S. forces invaded. Then the Mujahideen would swarm upon them and bleed them until the entire American empire fell from its wounds. It had happened to Great Britain and to the Soviet Union. He was certain it would happen to America. The declaration of war, the strike on the American embassies, and now the bombing of the coal had been inadequate, however, to provoke a massive retaliation. He would have to create an irresistible outrage. One can ask at this point whether 9/11 or some similar tragedy might have happened without bin Laden to steer it. The answer is certainly not. Indeed, the tectonic plates of history were shifting, promoting a period of conflict between the West and the Arab Muslim world. However, the charisma and vision of a few individuals shaped the nature of this contest. The international Salafist uprising might have occurred without the writings of Sayyid Qutb or Abdullah Azzam's call to jihad, but Al-Qaeda would not have existed. Al-Qaeda depended on a unique conjunction of personalities, in particular the Egyptians, Zawahiri, Abu Ubaidah, Saif al-Adl, and Abu Hafs, each of whom manifested the thoughts of Qutb, their intellectual father. But without bin Laden, the Egyptians were only al-Jihad. Their goals were parochial. At a time when there were many Islamist movements, all of them concentrated on nationalist goals, it was bin Laden's vision to create an international jihad corps. It was his leadership that held together an organization that had been bankrupted and thrown into exile. It was bin Laden's tenacity that made him deaf to the moral quarrels that attended the murder of so many, and indifferent to the repeated failures that would have destroyed most men's dreams. All of these were qualities that one can ascribe to a cult leader or a madman. But there was also artistry involved, not only to achieve the spectacular effect, but also to enlist the imagination of the men whose lives bin Laden required. Chapter 19. The Big Wedding. Social events were rare in the Al-Qaeda community, but bin Laden was in the mood to celebrate. He arranged a marriage between his 17-year-old son, Muhammad, and Abu Hafs' 14-year-old daughter, Khadija. She was a quiet, unlettered girl, and the women wondered what she and Muhammad would have to say to each other. They could just imagine the surprises that awaited her on her wedding night, since sexual matters were rarely discussed, especially with children. For the occasion, bin Laden had taken over a large hall, a former movie theater on the outskirts of Kandahar that had been gutted by the Taliban, to accommodate the 500 men in attendance. The women were in a separate facility with the young bride. He began the festivities by reading a long poem, apologizing that it was not his own work but that of his speechwriter. "I am not, as most of our brothers know, a warrior of the word," he said modestly. The poem included a tribute to the bombing of the coal. "A destroyer, even the brave might fear. She inspires horror in the harbor and the open sea. She goes into the waves, flanked by arrogance, haughtiness, and fake might. To her doom she progresses slowly, clothed in a huge illusion. Awaiting her is a dinghy bobbing in the waves." Two television cameras recorded the event, but bin Laden wasn't satisfied with the result, knowing that the poem would be featured on the Arabic satellite channels and an Al-Qaeda recruitment video. So he had the cameras set up again the following morning to record his recitation a second time. He even stationed a few supporters in front of him to cry out praise, as if there were hundreds still in the hall, instead of a handful of reporters and cameramen. His image management extended to asking one of the reporters, who had taken a digital snapshot, to take another picture because his neck was too full. He had dyed his beard,
to cover the streaks of gray, but he couldn't disguise the dark circles under his eyes that testified to the anxiety and sleeplessness that had become his steady companions. 12-year-old Hamza, the only child of bin Laden's favorite wife, also read a poem at the wedding. He had long black eyelashes and his father's thin face, and he wore a white turban and a camouflage vest. "What crime have we committed to be forced to leave our country?" he asked solemnly with impressive composure. "We will fight the Kafir forever." "Allahu Akbar," the men roared in response. Then they began to sing, "Our men are in revolt, our men are in revolt. We will not regain our homeland, nor will our shame be erased except through blood and fire." On and on it goes, on and on it goes. Following afternoon prayer, the meal was served, meat, rice, and tomato juice. It was a rare extravagance for bin Laden. Some of the diners thought the food rather primitive, however, and his stepfather noticed something larval squirming inside his water glass. "Eat, eat," the guests cried as they peeled oranges for the young groom. "He has a long night ahead." The men remarked how much the son's shy smile resembled his father's. They danced and sang more songs and lifted the boy up and cheered. Then they put him in a car and sent him to the family compound for his first night of married life. A few months after the inauguration of George W. Bush, Dick Clark met with Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor for the incoming Bush administration, and asked to be reassigned. From the moment the new team had taken over, it was clear that terrorism had a lower priority. When Clark first briefed her in January about the threat that bin Laden and his organization posed to the United States, Rice had given him the impression that she had never heard of Al-Qaeda. She subsequently downgraded his position, that of the National Coordinator for Counterterrorism, so that he would now be reporting to deputies, not to principals. Clark pressed his strategy of aiding Ahmad Shah Massoud and the Northern Alliance in their struggle against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but Rice demurred, saying that the administration needed a broader strategy that would include other Pashtun opponents of the Taliban. But the planning for that dragged on for months without much force. "Maybe you need someone less obsessive," Clark now suggested, his irony lost on Rice and her deputy, Stephen Hadley. They were surprised and asked him to stay on until October. During that time, they told him, he should find someone similar to replace him. "There's only one guy that fits that bill," said Clark. O'Neill viewed Clark's job as a perfect fit for him. The offer came at a time when he was despairing about the government's tangled response to terrorism and distressed about his future. He had always harbored two aspirations: to become deputy director of the bureau in Washington or to take over the New York office. Free was retiring in June, so there would be some vacancies at the top, but the investigation into the briefcase incident would likely block any promotion in the bureau. As the nation's new terrorism czar, however, he would be personally vindicated, and he must have relished the prospect of having both the FBI and the CIA answer to him. On the other hand, he was financially pressed, and he would still be at the same pay grade in the White House as in the Bureau. The Justice Department inquiry had been a ruinous blow. In addition to his other debts, he now owed his attorney $80,000, more than he took home in a year. Throughout the summer, Clark courted O'Neill, who agonized but refused to commit. He discussed the offer with a number of friends but became alarmed when he thought that FBI headquarters might hear of it. He called Clark in a fit of anxiety and said that people in the CIA knew he was being considered. "You have to tell them it's not true," he pleaded. He was certain that if the agency knew, the Bureau was sure to find out. Clark dutifully called one of his friends in the CIA and said that, by the way, he was looking for names for his replacement, since O'Neill had turned him down, even though O'Neill still wanted to be a candidate for that position. O'Neill also talked about the offer to Mon, saying that he didn't want him to hear it through the grapevine, but he pointedly told Mon he wasn't at all interested in the job. Money would have been a barrier, but O'Neill, by now a veteran bureaucratic infighter, also understood the ruthlessness with which some powerful people in Washington would greet the news of his new position. Clark's offer was tempting, but it was also dangerous. For years, Zawahiri had been battling elements inside al-Jihad who opposed his relationship with bin Laden. He spewed disdain on the Jihad members who found fault with him from comfortable perches in Europe. He called them the hot-blooded revolutionary strugglers who have now become as cold as ice after they experienced the life of civilization and luxury. Increasingly, many of his former allies, exhausted and demoralized by years of setbacks, had become advocates of the initiative by Islamist leaders imprisoned in Egypt, who had declared a unilateral ceasefire. Others no longer wanted to endure the primitive living conditions in Afghanistan. Yet even as the organization was disintegrating, Zawahiri rejected any thought of negotiating with the Egyptian regime or with the West. In an angry moment, he actually resigned as the emir of al-Jihad, but without him, the organization was totally adrift. Several months later, his successor relinquished the post, and Zawahiri was back in charge. According to testimony given at the trial of the Albanian cell members, however, there were only 40 members left outside Egypt, and within the country the movement had been eradicated. Al-Jihad was dying, and with it the dream that had animated Zawahiri's imagination since he was a teenager. Egypt was lost to him. The end came in June 2001, when Al-Qaeda absorbed Al-Jihad, creating an entity formally called Qaeda al-Jihad. The name reflected the fact that the Egyptians still made up the inner circle. The 9-member leadership council included only 3 non-Egyptians, but it was bin Laden's organization, not Zawahiri's. Naturally, the domination by the Egyptians was a subject of contention, especially among the Saudi members of al-Qaeda. Bin Laden tried to mollify the malcontents by explaining that he could always count on the Egyptians because they were unable to go home without being arrested. Like him, they were men without a country. Bin Laden turned to Zawahiri and the Egyptians with a particular task. He wanted them to kill Ahmad Shah Massoud. The Northern Alliance commander represented the only credible force keeping the Taliban from completely consolidating their hold on Afghanistan. Slender and dashing, Massoud was a brilliant tactician, and he was willing to match the Taliban in ruthlessness. Now that the Taliban had allied itself with al-Qaeda, Dick Clark and others saw Massoud as the last chance for an Afghan solution to the bin Laden problem. Massoud was an eager partner. He was himself a dedicated Islamist whose wife wore a burqa and whose troops had committed more than one massacre. Like his competitors, he probably supported his militia on the opium trade. But he spoke a rudimentary French, which he learned in high school in Kabul, and he was well known for his love of Persian poetry, which made him seem like a civilized alternative to the Taliban. In February, Taliban goons had gone through the Kabul Museum with sledgehammers, pulverizing the artistic heritage of the country. Then in March, they used tanks and anti-aircraft weapons in Bamiyan province to destroy 2 colossal images of the Buddha that had loomed above the ancient Silk Road for 1,500 years. To the degree that the Taliban were sinking in the world's estimation, Massoud was rising. In a reflection of his increased international stature, Massoud addressed the European Parliament in Strasbourg, France, in April 2001. He spoke about the danger that al-Qaeda posed to the world. He also told American officials that his own intelligence had learned of al-Qaeda's intention to perform a terrorist act against the United States that would be vastly greater than the bombings of the American embassies in East Africa. In July, Zawahiri composed a letter in poorly written French, purporting to be from the Islamic Observation Center in London. He requested permission for 2 journalists to interview Massoud. That letter was followed up by a personal recommendation from Abdul Rasul Sayyaf. Permission was granted. Massoud was not alone in his warnings to America. In addition to the gleeful chatter that the NSA was picking up about a major attack, spectacular, another Hiroshima, that was in the works, intelligence agencies from Arab countries, with better human sources, issued dire advisories. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak warned the United States that terrorists were planning to attack President Bush in Rome, using an airplane stuffed with explosives, while he was on his way to the G8 summit in Genoa that July. The Italian authorities put up anti-aircraft impl-